Good morning, everyone. It is about 4:15 on the morning of March 3rd, 2013. The cold weather has finally broken here in Winnipeg. We still have quite a bit of winter left to go through, but people are now able to smell the spring in the air, and everybody's smiling. It's amazing what a bit of warm weather can actually do to one's psyche. I've had 12 people write in this month, and some interesting stuff to respond to. But as always, I want to thank everyone who has contributed in some way this month, either sending in a question or sending in donations. Many of you have sent in comments of appreciation. And as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place and for posting these talks every month. People have already begun to sign up for the retreat and the London weekend that will be coming up this year at the end of August, when I make my trip to the UK. So that's nice to see that there's some interest in that. This weekend I've managed to get a bit of time to myself, so I'm getting a few things done. Yesterday I spent the day working out taxes, and I'm getting around to this response, squeezing it in between loads of laundry. Oh, the enlightened life. So before I get on to my next load of laundry, let's get into some of these questions that have come in this month. The first person who has written in actually wrote in a question one day and then 3 days later amended the whole thing. But I'll just read this first bit that he sent in, and I'd like to respond to some of that, and then we'll move on to his amendment. So he wrote in saying, "Hi, Daryl. Here's a question for you, if you'd like to answer. You've studied Buddhism. Would you agree that there is an end to suffering? I suppose you wouldn't, but I'd like to hear your take on what the Gotama meant in that time and context." So the word Gotama here is, the Buddha's actual name was Gotama Siddhartha. That was just a reference to the Buddha. He goes on to say, "Without any notion of a world or of a self or name and form whatsoever, we are nonetheless, as you put it, aware that something is happening. We have, out of absolutely unknowable, indescribable conditions, emerged as a present reaction to and within that something, and are compelled right now to react to it. While I agree with you that we cannot predict that reaction beforehand, I still have a choice, even though I can't describe the limits of that choice. To posit that we have no free will is to posit a machine-like existence. I'm sure we both agree that the complexity of this existence is beyond either descriptions of free will or determinism, and I think I've heard you say so even in this last podcast. Our present reaction, in our everyday sense of experience, is to some degree under our control and even if we can never know what to what degree, because we're always in the so-called present, it doesn't follow that I am unable to move my hand out of a fire if I am aware that it is painful. I hope you get my drift and look forward to your response. I can predict that it will be interesting. So this first question, he points out, I've studied Buddhism. He asks if I would agree that there is an end to suffering. And he'd like to hear my take on what the Buddha meant in that time and context. It's stated quite clearly within the recorded teaching of the Buddha what it was that he meant by suffering. He basically said that it was the five focuses that we cling to in life. And basically, it's clinging to physical forms, certain physical forms, certain feelings, certain mental activities, certain states of consciousness. And certain perceptions. And he very specifically pointed out that the clinging to these things is the result of a desire which arises when things have the appearance of being enjoyable and ultimately fulfilling. So what the Buddha was pointing to was an extreme frustration that most people find in life because they have the impression that certain things are going to be ultimately fulfilling. So, you know, we look around at the various forms in existence, whether it be a physical form, a feeling, a perception, a mental activity, or a state of consciousness. You know, we identify certain forms, whether they be what we would call physical forms or mental forms, and we identify some of them as being pleasant. But if there is a feeling that any of them are ultimately fulfilling, then we want to hang on to them. We think we're going to hang on to them in order to make ourselves happy. And the Buddha was pointing out that this is impossible because everything is changing. That there is no particular form to existence. So those physical forms that we want to hang on to in a certain way, those are changing. You know, our bodies are changing. Physical circumstances are changing. The job situation is changing. The physical situation of the relationship is changing. The physical being of our lover is changing. The apparent form that we would call a feeling is changing, or a perception is changing. Mental activities are shifting all the time, and particular states of consciousness are always moving on to some other apparent expression. And so it is that if we think any of those things are ultimately fulfilling, we're going to be frustrated. In certain situations, the desire for these things to fulfill us can be extreme, and therefore the frustration becomes an extreme suffering. When we realize that once again we can't hold on to a certain situation, so very simply, the end of suffering, as the Buddha would describe it, is really the end of this frustration with life. And that comes to an end when we realize that there isn't any situation in life that's going to ultimately satisfy us or keep us feeling happy and safe and secure all the time. That it's the nature of life to move and shift and present itself in any number of ways. So when the expectation that life is going to present itself in a certain way and maintain that presentation, when that expectation falls away, the frustration is no longer present. The disappointment is no longer present. And when I say that, I should add that it's the disappointment of that expectation, the expectation that something is going to fulfill us for the rest of our life, that we're going to come to some pleasant physical situation, some pleasant feeling, some pleasant perception, some pleasant mental activity, or some pleasant state of consciousness, and that that is somehow going to remain always. When that expectation, when that unrealistic expectation fades away, then it can't be frustrated. And that particular suffering can no longer arise. But that doesn't mean it's not going to be painful, and it doesn't mean that there won't be minor sorrows or even quite extreme sorrows at times, because all of that is the natural expression of life. So even the Buddha had extreme back pain, to the point that in certain situations, he wasn't able to finish a teaching. He had to lie down and let some other monk finish his teaching because the pain that he was experiencing was so extreme. He really couldn't complete that teaching. It's also the case that when his two closest disciples, the two students that he felt were most accomplished, when those two students died before he did, it's also the case that he gathered together the monks that he was living with, and he basically declared that the entire assembly of monks was now empty for him. That with the death of these two friends, the assembly felt empty to him. So, even for the Buddha, life still had its difficulties, its pains. Now, in the second portion of what this person has sent in, he's gone on to describe that even though we can say that what's happening here is absolutely unknowable, indescribable, that somehow within that, what arises out of that is this situation where it feels as though we're somebody in a world and in a situation where we're reacting to the world apparently around us. It seems that we really do have choices to make. And even though we can't really come to any specific description of how much of a choice we have, it still seems that we're able to move our hand out of a fire when we're aware that it's painful. So here's one of the really fascinating aspects of this non-dual sensibility, and one of the really interesting apparent expressions of existence, because for most people, that are drawn to this non-dual perspective. We can all agree that this is ultimately a totally unexplainable, unformed event presenting itself. But it seems that for most apparent people that are drawn to this non-dual sensibility, for most people that are expressed with this sensibility, in one breath they'll say, yes, it's true, I agree with you. Everything that's happening here is unexplainable, it has no particular form, we're not doing any of it. But on our day-to-day, in our day-to-day life, there is this situation where we're making decisions and we seem to have a certain amount of control. And so this is a very fascinating aspect of this movement into a non-dual sensibility, because that's a total denial to maintain that this day-to-day experience, this day-to-day sensibility of existence, somehow has any real validity, is to deny totally the fact that this is an unexplainable, unformed event, simply eventing. And interestingly enough, this person, when he wrote in, a few days later, he wrote back to say that he came to that realization. So a few days later, he wrote back saying, "Hi, Daryl. I see the fallacy of the question I asked you the other day, and after much reflection, have recognized much more of the importance of your perspective in my daily experience." Now he's put the word perspective in quotation marks, and then he writes, I put the word perspective in quotation marks out of respect, because your perspective puts quotation marks on all perspectives, including itself. Any description of anything says nothing about anything. Even descriptions themselves are insubstantial, circumstantial, relative, empty, illusory, etc., etc., etc. From really exploring your ideas, I've relieved myself of two notions. First, that there is something to know, a truth, either known or hidden, by anyone, and indeed that there is a concrete anyone to know anything. There is no ultimate or even relative truth or way or path. Indeed, I notice the true irony and danger of those descriptions. As you so astutely put it, the need to know comes from the need to control, which brings me to the second notion that I've been relieved of. And that second notion is this: that I can in any way know what is the origin or outcome or even the nature of what is described as my action. Debates on ethics or causality make a monumental presumption. They assume there are people and things, actions and outcomes, but these are as artificial, stereotypical, inaccurate as geometrical proofs. Even the way I phrase the example, I know how to remove my hand from the fire. What hand? What fire? When? If my question was, is there an end to suffering, I could now answer, for whom? Even suffering, pain, pleasure, and every experience is ungraspable, unformed, unpredictable, unexplainable. We may come to embrace this or not, but we'll never embrace this the same way twice, or even once. This email has gone on long enough. I deeply enjoy thinking, reading, and talking about these matters, and I don't know anyone at all who sees things this way, even in the spiritual circles I frequented. I'd be much better off talking to the bus driver amidst the winter snows about how it all works. So I would just like to say yes to all of that. In his first bit of writing, he was stating that yes, he agreed that everything is without form, everything is unexplainable, it's just this great mysterious happening, simply happening. But, you know, within our day-to-day existence, within the relative viewpoints, we do have some sense of choice. We have these situations where if our hand is in a fire, we can realize that it's being, that we're being hurt, and that we can pull the hand out of that fire. And now in this second bit of writing, he's written in to say that he realizes, no, it is simply just a totally unexplainable event. And that this question regarding the fire, regarding the hand, regarding cause and effect, regarding choice, all of these questions are making this monumental presumption. It's assuming the notion of people and a surrounding world. So it's still very much within this totally false description of existence. And that ultimately, all of that is also a totally unexplainable event. The descriptions themselves are a totally unexplainable event. I only call them a description. I only call them thought, because someone told me to call them thought. And the words thought, the word description, it's a totally meaningless sound. It just points to this event that we call thoughts and descriptions. Even those are a totally mysterious happening, simply happening the way they happen. From this non-dual perspective, they're really nothing to be concerned about. They simply happen the way they happen, in the same way that clouds drift in the sky, or rivers flow a certain way, or a storm plays out the way it plays out. Everything is moving and shifting in this way. And the world of thought, how much we get attached to thought, how much we let go of thought, all of that is simply moving and shifting in the way that those clouds drift here and there, the way the river flows, the way a storm might play out. All of it is simply the movement of this larger, unexplainable event that we might call nature, or the universe, or the Great Spirit, or the unformed ocean of existence. So, as this person has stated, ultimately, there isn't any big truth to know. There isn't any particular way or path to realize. There isn't any way to know anything about the nature of our actions and outcomes. All of this is a totally unformed, unpredictable, unexplainable, ungraspable happening. And that, as I'm always pointing out, even this non-dual sensibility is a totally unexplainable happening. This is just a mysterious happening. It's not someone coming to some ultimate truth. It's not someone having a clearer sense of existence than someone else. There isn't anybody realizing a truth. There isn't anyone coming to a non-dual sensibility. All of that is still within this false storyline. There is only this totally mysterious eventing of this moment. And even that is to say too much. There's just this doing what it does. All right, second person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl. I want to thank you so much for your sharings, including your books and website offerings. Your perspective resonates deeply and has been such a gift. As I've been digesting your perspective, it seems this mind is finally done with wanting to learn more information. That's a small miracle in itself after years of having a compulsive desire to learn more and more, reading nearly everything available on the topic of non-duality and related topics. Also, as I recently listened to one of your questions and answers, I suddenly came to know beyond the intellect, there's only now, just this. Along with that realization came a deeper sense of well-being and a slight shift in perspective. Although I wouldn't say true realization has occurred. Now it seems I am without questions, except for one. My question is about the value and or benefit of spending time in person with a teacher. Is it true that in being with a teacher there's a transmission or an alignment process that happens which is beneficial? If one goes deeper into meditation while being with a teacher, is that helpful? Thank you again, Daryl, for taking the time to answer my question and for all you are offering us. It is all greatly appreciated." Okay, so the question is it true that in being with a teacher there's a transmission or an alignment process that happens which is beneficial? If one goes deeper into meditation while being with a teacher, is that helpful? Well, as always, it's different for each apparent person. Each one of us is unique, and in this situation of someone coming to apparently realize a non-dual perspective, for each apparent person, it's also unique. So there are those who have found that going to spend time with a teacher has been of great benefit. And it seems as though simply spending time in that teacher's company has allowed a fuller sense of this non-dual perspective. And that's not some magical, mystical transmission. You know, often people have some strange notions of what a non-dual sensibility will give rise to. And they have the feeling that someone who has this sensibility will be extraordinary. And often, really, the important thing to come to realize is that they're very ordinary. Outside of the apparent non-dual perspective, everything else about them is pretty ordinary. Now, I know there are certain teachers that seem to be very special and they seem to be highly developed, but the fact of the matter is, you can be someone who is very ordinary, someone like Robert Adams or William Johnson, or even someone like U.G. Krishnamurti, who in certain ways seem to be pretty cantankerous, not very socially skilled, and not even developed in certain ways that we would consider to be ordinary. And so to see that this person who doesn't seem so special still has this very clear sense of life being this totally mysterious dance that's an important thing to apparently learn, because we really see that once this realization arises, there isn't any expectation to be something special. There's simply whatever life presents, and that doesn't have to be so special. It can seem pretty ordinary. However, it's also the case that, like in my apparent journey, there were many things that arose in the company of certain teachers, but it's also the case that the final bit of realization came when I was lying in bed with my girlfriend reading a book by Ramesh Balsekar. And it was simply, it seemed, in this apparent journey and in this apparent realization that I was basically reading one particular sentence in a book, and this provoked a certain investigation in my memory, a search to find some example of me actually directing my existence. And in that investigation, it became very obvious that I had no experience anywhere of me directing my life. And in that moment, what remained was simply a totally unexplainable event, simply eventing. So it didn't require a particular teacher being present. It didn't require my spending time with that teacher. And since that moment, I haven't spent any time with any particular teacher. So all of it seemed to simply happen on its own, in a way. Again, all of this is within the storylines which are not the ultimate truth. These stories of apparent journeys and apparent realizations. So again, from this non-dual perspective, there is just this event of life, and it's going to express an apparent you in whatever way it expresses you. It's different for each of us. It's nothing to be too concerned about, because basically you're going to do whatever you're going to do. You will be drawn to explore whatever you're drawn to explore. And none of that is our doing. It's simply the flowing of this great mysterious river of life. Okay. A third person has written in saying, perhaps this is something for the monthly question and answers. Although it's not really a question, it's more of a sharing. I don't know if you're familiar with the writing of Sam Harris, but his take on things seems resonant with a non-dual perspective. And then this person has sent in an article from a blog by this Sam Harris. I'm not familiar with this person. And the person who's written in sending this piece says, I think there are echoes in this piece of the Schopenhauer line that you love to quote, you can do what you want, but you can't will what it is that you want. Thank you for sharing your perspective so clearly. Warm regards. And this piece that he sent in goes this way. How, for instance, does one become a pediatric surgeon? Well, you must first be born with an intact nervous system and then be provided with a proper education. No freedom there, I'm afraid. You must also have the physical talent for the job and avoid smashing your hands at rugby. Needless to say, it won't do to be someone who faints at the sight of blood. chalk these achievements up to good luck as well. At some point, you must decide to become a surgeon, a result, presumably, of first wanting to become one. Will you be the conscious source of this wanting? Will you be responsible for its prevailing over all the other things you want, but that are incompatible with a career in medicine? No. If you succeed at becoming a surgeon, you will simply find yourself standing one day, scalpel in hand, at the confluence of all the genetic and environmental causes that led you to develop along this line. None of these events requires that you, the conscious subject, be the ultimate cause of your aspirations, abilities, and resulting behavior. And needless to say, you can take no credit for the fact that you weren't born a psychopath. Of course, I'm not saying that you can become a surgeon by accident. You must do many things, deliberately and well, and in the appropriate sequence, year after year. Becoming a surgeon requires effort, but can you take credit for your disposition to make that effort? To turn the matter around, am I responsible for the fact that it has never once occurred to me that I might like to be a surgeon? Who gets the blame for my lack of inspiration? And what if the desire to become a surgeon suddenly arises tomorrow and becomes so intense that I throw away my other professional goals and enroll in medical school? Would I, that is, the part of me that is actually experiencing my life, be the true cause of these developments? Every moment of conscious effort, every thought, intention, and decision will have been caused by events of which I am not conscious. Where's the freedom in this? So again, someone is simply pointing out that our intention to become a surgeon isn't something we create. Our abilities to be a surgeon aren't something that we create. Our needs, our interests, our concerns, our abilities, our lack of abilities, none of this do we create. It's simply the movement of this larger expression of existence. Now, in this particular passage, this person is still talking about a conscious observer of existence, and I'm saying that storyline isn't true. He's pointing out that we have to make a conscious effort to move in a particular direction, and I'm saying that it's not really us making a conscious effort, that's a compulsive expression of existence, that if we become a surgeon, all of the effort that seems to arise in that direction is simply the compulsive expression of existence. If we become a surgeon, it's the fact that we couldn't possibly have done anything else. If we don't become a surgeon, it's the fact that we couldn't really have done anything else. But again, even in this passage, it's a simple acknowledgement of what's obvious. That we don't create our needs, we don't create our interests, we don't create our particular concerns in our daily life, we don't create our particular urges, we don't create the fact that an urge is strong enough or becomes strong enough that it apparently provokes an action. We don't create our particular abilities in a particular action, and we don't create our lack of abilities in a particular action. All of this is simply a great mysterious dance. Basically, you know, we could say it's a physical event, eventing. Even moods and thoughts, these are simply a physical action taking place, like the flowing of a river, like the drifting of a cloud in the sky, like the waving action of an ocean. the tides and movements of a great ocean. All of it is simply the streaming of a universe. And again, universe literally meaning undivided turning. So it's the streaming of an undivided turning, a moving, shifting, dancing event, simply eventing. As always, keep in mind, this is just for your consideration. I'm not asking that anybody else look at life in this way. I'm simply presenting this perspective. If you relate to it, that's great. If you don't relate to it, that's great. This is not the one true sense of existence. It's just one of the many mysterious expressions of existence. Maybe you're apparently expressed in a similar way. That's wonderful. Maybe you're not expressed in this way. That's wonderful. Either way, it's a legitimate expression of existence. A fourth person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl, or should I call you, me, and all this the infinite unisomething verse?" Probably not. It's a little confusing. So, Daryl, it is. I'd like to move you off your favored territory by asking you something worldly. And he put the word worldly in quotation marks. And then in the following line, he says, "It's funny, you'll have to explain how that word was in quotation marks. And you're going to have to explain how this sentence is in quotation marks, or in parentheses, I should say." So he goes on to say, "Let's just assume that you and I and several of the other listeners are all of the same mind. We accept that all this is whatever, and we all naturally have our own way of saying it. Let's just take that as given. Now let's assume that in all of this, there is a me asking you a question and that you will answer. Assuming all of this, is an inexplicable happening of a no thing. And it all just does what it does. Good comes, good goes, it's replaced by the seemingly bad, and then it's off again. I'd like you to share some practical tips, some one-liners, some words, even actions aimed at the seeming entity I call me, and what we all call me when shit really seems to happen. What do you say to yourself when something really miserable comes along? What would you do, say, in my imaginary position, when the pressures of deadlines meets the refusal of machinery to work, and also meets the tornado of pressure from a non-understanding boss? Maybe you will answer that we do whatever we do. We explode or deal with it beautifully, based on our unchosen, predisposed biology. And no matter what, that's perfect, not our doing, and something we have no say over. Yet, that may be a little bit of a sidestep, if you don't mind me saying. I'd like, aside from the non-dual perspective that draws us all together, I'd like some practical advice. There must be some method that Daryl has used along the way, a trick for calming the storm. I'm asking you and believe you'll answer, which, to the point or not, I'll enjoy anyway. Thanks. Bye for now." Okay, out of all of that, it comes down to this. You want some practical advice. You want to know if there's some method that I've used for calming the storm. Okay. You want me to stay within that worldly view? You want me to stay within the false story of existence and describe what methods Daryl has used for dealing with the really difficult situations in life? Okay. let's see what happens here. You're asking for a trick for calming storms. So here's the first trick. I don't really want to calm a storm because I'm aware that life has storms. So I'm not so much interested in calming a storm. I'm more interested in weathering a storm. Now, in this situation that's described here, he talks about a situation where there's a pressure of deadlines, and even though there's a deadline to be met, the machinery that's being used is refusing to work properly, and that's creating some kind of difficulty, and then there's a lot of pressure coming from a non-understanding boss. So what would I do in that particular situation? What are the practical things that I would bring up in relation to that situation? And as it happens, I live with that situation quite a bit. Not all the time, but a certain amount. So with my job in the warehouse, at the end of the day, we often have many different shipments that have to be processed on the computer. And I have to get that processed by a certain time in the day so that the various couriers that we use for shipping all across Canada and into the States and sometimes to Japan and Australia, so that the couriers that are going to pick up all of these shipments will be able to pick them up at a certain time. And every so often, the computer breaks down, and there's the pressure of needing to get this stuff out. So what are the practical things that I bring to a situation like that for weathering the storm? I'm not interested in calming that storm. I'm not interested in trying to get rid of the pressure from that situation, because it is a pressured situation. So the first thing that I would do is acknowledge that this is a pressure-filled situation. There's the pressure of the deadline that's coming up. There's the pressure of the fact that the machinery isn't working properly. And there's the fact that there will be some kind of comment from my employer if it's not getting done. There's a certain attitude. There's the pressure within my employer who wants this done in a certain way at a certain time. Now, often people are wanting to discover some way of relaxing in a situation like that so that it's not bothering them at all. But to me, that's ridiculous, because it is a pressure-filled situation. There's an expectation that something is going to get done at a certain time, and now there are certain things preventing the fact that it's going to get done, preventing the possibility of it getting done at a certain point. So that is a frustrating situation. And we're not going to be able to sweep away the fact that this is our job and that there's a certain expectation there of getting something done at a certain time. And now there's something that's an obstacle to things getting done at a certain time. We're not going to sweep away that fact, because you'd have to be brain dead in order to sweep that away. The whole functioning of an apparent brain is to be sensitive to the circumstances around it and to respond to it in an appropriate way. So again, I wouldn't expect any possibility of calming that pressure in that situation, of calming the storm of that situation. It becomes a matter of weathering the storm in an appropriate way. So first and foremost, in my particular case, it's the acknowledgement that none of this is personal. It's just the way things are set up in life. My boss's emotions aren't personal. They're the way he's expressed. The working of the computer isn't personal. The computer either works or it doesn't work. The pressures I'm feeling within that situation aren't personal. It's just the way I'm expressed in this situation. There is a deadline to be met, and there are difficulties arising in meeting that deadline. So there's a feeling of pressure around all of that, and none of it is personal. In my particular expression, for whatever reason, when I wake up in the morning, there's a very short consideration of what I know about life. That just arises automatically. And the bottom line is always, I know that it is simply a totally mysterious event, presenting whatever it's going to present. And I don't really know what it's going to present in that particular day. So like a certain Zen master I heard about, one of the historical Zen masters, he would begin his day in the monastery by throwing open the shutters of his bedroom and shouting out over the countryside, "What have you got for me today?" Because he didn't know what was coming. It might be something pleasant, it might be something that was not so pleasant, but whatever it was the natural expression of the universe. And for whatever reason, you know, again, I have no explanation for this. Every morning when I wake up, there's a short consideration of that fact. I don't know what's coming. It's not personal. It's all simply the dance of this greater mysterious event of existence. And every night before I fall asleep, the same fact presents itself. I don't make it happen. It just happens. There's an acknowledgement of this greater mysterious event of existence, and a number of times during the day, it automatically is acknowledged. I don't plan to acknowledge it, it just acknowledges that there's this great mysterious dance of existence. It's just always a totally enigmatic shifting of events. So, often, probably most often, in these pressure-filled situations, it's just a fact that none of it is personal. So instead of getting caught up in some of the emotional pressures, even though there may be some emotional pressures presenting themselves, instead of getting caught up in that, there's more of an orientation to simply, okay, it's like being in a, you know, it's like going down a river and all of a sudden you encounter rapids and you're going to have to maneuver in a certain way in order to avoid the rocks and move through this tense situation on the river. So here it is, the river of life, and there's this pressure-filled situation. So it becomes a matter of basically how efficiently can I move through this particular situation. In the past, I've even had this feeling that it's a bit like being a race car driver, where you have to respond with split-second timing in order to maneuver through the difficult situation of driving a race car and moving through other race cars as you compete against them. And so in this pressure-filled situation of getting certain shipments out by a certain time at the end of the day, a lot of people are depending on this happening in a certain way. It becomes a matter of just approaching that in the most efficient way. Now, it's also the case that there are times when I don't have the feeling that it's a totally impersonal event. And the mind, the apparent mind, gets caught up totally in the emotional aspects of this whole situation. So in that particular moment, I might be saying something like, ah, oh, shit, here we go again. It's just a total disaster. And my emotions plummet. As I mentioned earlier, I'm not interested in getting rid of storms. It's a fact that storms occur. So even though this non-dual perspective apparently allows me to look at certain pressure-filled situations in a very impersonal way, and it allows me to deal with that from the viewpoint of simply dealing with it in the most efficient way that I can, and maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't work out. There are certain days where it doesn't really seem to matter too much to me either way, because ultimately all of it is impersonal. It's just a situation which has to be responded to. However, there are the days that I don't have that cool and calm approach to this. I don't have this measured, efficient apparent response to this situation. Instead, the emotions somehow push themselves forward, and the whole thing feels unfair. Who's this boss to be on my back in this way, and why am I even in this pressure-filled situation? Like, who needs this job? And it's on those days that I want to get up and just walk out the door right then and there and never come back. And I'm saying things like, shit, I hate this, and I'm turning to people and say, screw you, just get away from me. And all of that's the natural expression of existence. I don't have to be some kind of abstract notion of perfection. I'm whatever life expresses in any particular situation. And even when I know that, and the emotions push themselves forward in a very strong way, it doesn't make them feel pleasant. It doesn't make me feel above life. I never feel above life. I am the movement of life. It presents in whatever way it presents. So, some days, it seems like the practical way of weathering the storm is simply to be calm and cool and efficient and detached. And other days, the way to weather the storm is to get emotionally unhinged and to say a few caustic comments to the people around me. And to simply sit there stewing, thinking, who needs this job? I don't need this kind of crap. I just want to get out of here. Now, you should also perhaps keep in mind that in my particular expression in life, I was drawn to practices involving deep awareness, what we would call deep awareness of the moment, and deep concentration. And I explored a million and one different techniques, apparent techniques, for moving into these deep states of concentration. And I could be in situations where thoughts would not arise for very long periods of time. And I would experience, on long retreats, I would experience incredibly profound states of rest. But you know something? In the middle of a pressure-filled situation, it doesn't really count for much, because in a pressure-filled situation, in your day-to-day existence, you have to respond to that pressure-filled situation. You can't somehow imagine yourself on retreat and ignore everything that's going on around you. So it's simply the matter of moving into, moving through the various events of existence. And that's going to present in whatever way it presents. The most practical thing that I've run across in relating to life's events is the simple acknowledgement that life has no particular form. That even my doing isn't my doing. That there isn't any particular arriving anywhere. You don't arrive to a state of calm and then stay there. You don't arrive to a state of pressure and then stay there. Life is always moving and shifting and dancing. It doesn't have a particular form. It doesn't have any explanation. And all of that leaves me with the impression that it will simply present me the way it presents me, because I don't exist as anything above the movement of existence. I don't exist as anything apart from the movement of existence. I am the dance of existence. I am this ongoing, magical adventure. And there's no way of predicting exactly how it's going to present itself. In my particular apparent expression, for the most part, it presents me as someone who stands back to observe. It presents me as someone who explores a situation, explores possibilities in the situation, in a pressure-filled situation. Automatically, I pull back to observe possibilities. I feel my way through the situation in general, looking for the most efficient and unemotional way of approaching that situation. And yet it's also the case that in some of those situations, I'm totally emotionally involved, that the emotions push themselves forward in a way where I'm really totally whacked out. Saying certain things to certain people, behaving in a certain way that a little while later, there will be a feeling of regret for saying something to somebody, or there will be a feeling of regret for behaving in a certain way. And all of that is the totally unexplainable dance of existence. The most practical tip that I can think of for approaching any of life's situations is to acknowledge simply that none of it is our doing, and in life's presentation, we will be presented with certain inclinations. We will be presented with a certain sense of a certain situation and how it is that it feels most appropriate to approach that situation, but we're not going to be presented with ultimate control. And so in this question, you know, have I learned a method for calming the storm? This is again a search for ultimate control. And I've never found ultimate control. Nobody has. In my apparent life journey, I've been drawn to explore various ways of approaching life. I've been drawn to explore a million and one techniques for relaxing, for developing awareness. And basically all of that was the compulsive expression of existence. I never found any ultimate control in those explorations. I never found any way of maintaining constant calm. I never found any way of increasing awareness. There's just the apparent awareness that life gave me. You know, there's just the basic feeling that something's happening here. I never managed to get more awareness than that. There's just the basic feeling that something's happening here. But along with that, I also got the impression that this whole thing moves in ups and downs. And that for long periods of my life, it moves along at a very even pace, and I'm drawn to a nice, easygoing pace in life. And yet, even in a life that's apparently easygoing, there are storms. I've never managed to get rid of the storms. Another practical tip in this is that when we acknowledge that all of life is simply the dance of this greater mysterious event, we can perhaps begin to acknowledge how it is that that event expresses us. So in my case, I'm expressed in a way that even though I have what people would say is a lot of different abilities, you know, I can function within circumstances related to science or social work or art or business. I have talents in all of those different areas. It's also the fact that I have a certain energy level that life expresses. And that energy level can only take so much pressure. So in this acknowledgement of how life expresses me and how it expresses my most healthy sense of existence, you know, what it is that, you know, what situations I feel most balanced in and what situations I feel most healthy in, when I acknowledge those situations, when I acknowledge my abilities and when I acknowledge my abilities to deal with pressure, I find that over a lifetime I'm drawn to an easygoing situation. A life that's fairly relaxed. Overall, I don't want a lot of pressures. I'm not drawn to those kinds of situations. In that acknowledgement, I don't move toward pressure-filled jobs. So, in my acknowledgement of my particular personality, the personality that this greater mysterious dance of existence is expressing, I don't want to spend my life in pressure-filled situations. And so I will take less money in order to have a more easygoing existence. I will live a simpler life. I will live a life without a lot of the perks that most other people want. I will live a life where I'm not offered most of the material wealth that other people have, because I'm happier in a situation that has less pressure and therefore less money. However, it's also less demand on my time, and so I'm free to explore all of these different facets of life. I'm free to explore art and science and social relations, and I'm free to spend time with friends and family without the demands of these more highly pressured situations. So that's a very practical approach to life. To take a good look at what it is that actually makes you happy. To take a good look at how much money you actually need. To take a look at all the various options that are presented by life. Because that's another portion of my expression in life. I was drawn to study design, two-dimensional design, three-dimensional design, both in fine arts and architecture. The thing about studying design is it's simply problem solving. It's a matter of looking at a situation in life and considering all the possible options that are presented there. And from all of those possible options, looking at what is most feasible, most practical. So again, it's not so much a matter of calming a storm as weathering a storm. So not only might we consider how it is that we could efficiently move through this impersonal storm, when life offers us the opportunity to move through that storm in some kind of efficient and impersonal way, but it's also the case that outside of the storm, we might consider, do we want a life filled with storms? And what are the possible options in relation to a job that has a lot of pressure? Could we possibly get another job? Is there another situation which would be less pressure filled? There's also the practical aspect of, if we are living a very pressure filled life, if we have a job that has a lot of pressures, we're not going to get rid of those pressures. So outside of that pressure filled situation, what are we doing with the rest of our life? Are we allowing ourselves to relax? Do we explore the possibilities of relaxing? Do we explore the possibility of stepping away from that pressure-filled situation in order to have a bit more fun, in order to experience a situation where there isn't any pressure, in order to experience a period of relaxation? Because again, we're not going to get rid of storms. So in weathering the storm, is there a possibility of, in our downtime, experiencing a bit more joy, a bit more pleasure, a bit more calm? Or have we filled that part of our life with pressures as well? Anyway, this is going on too long. I don't know if any of this is helpful in any way, but it's all that's coming up in this moment. It looks like this particular response is going to run on quite a bit. It's already run on a little over an hour, so let's take a break here, and when you're ready to go on, you can move to the second portion of this.